You're listening to GCN, the Genesis Communication Radio Network.
Now, as promised, we want to go to Great Britain and get a line on the new regime there, the new Tory Liblab coalition that has now taken over. And so we want to get the view from two of the leading activists in the country. That would be Tony Gosling and Martin Summers, generally based in the Bristol area, I think, still. So we want to welcome them and let them take it away. Just, guys, remember, U.S. audience not too knowledgeable about these things, so give it to us straight. We got about 10 minutes. Go ahead.
Well, I think the main thing to say, Webster, is Tony Gosling here, is that there was no, as people know, there wasn't any kind of definitive result in the British general election, so we have three parties kind of having to make alliances in order to make things work over here. I think there's been a lot of spin talked about this Liberal Democrat Conservative alliance, but I'm not entirely convinced by it. I think one of the minutiae was that actually Gordon Brown resigned and David Cameron accepted the prime ministership from the Queen before the meeting at which the Liberal Democrat MPs, along with Nick Clegg, actually decided to have a pact with the Conservatives. So obviously there's a bit of a sort of attempt there to bounce these MPs into accepting this agreement that Clegg has made with David Cameron. The other big shock for me, really, is to see Kenneth Clark in such a powerful position. Now, he's very unpopular in many parts of the Conservative Party because he's so vehemently pro-Europe, whereas the natural Conservative line is generally anti-Europe. And so this is a little bit shocking. The other thing, of course, is that for many of your listeners who will know the way the Bilderberg conferences operate, I mean, these people are very, very much in the driving seat when it comes to financial policy, particularly here in the Western world. And it's fair to say, if people have ever been to my website, which is bilderberg.org, that the people that go to these conferences constitute really control of most of the money in the Western world via the central banks, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the European Central Bank, and the Federal Reserve. So what you can see here is that Ken Clark is a Bilderberger. He's not just any old Bilderberger. He sits there with David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger on the steering committee of Bilderberg, and he has just been given a real plum job here in David Cameron's new cabinet, which is a joint role of Justice Secretary with the recently created Justice Department and also Lord Chancellor. Now, I can remember in my O-level politics at school here, you know, when I was about 15, 16, being told about the role of Lord Chancellor as being quite a sort of weird, anomalous role where you've got one foot in the government and one in the judiciary. Now, of course, the separation of powers means that really there shouldn't really be such a role where the government and the judiciary is embodied in one single person. But Kenneth Clark has managed to grab that role, which means he's involved in appointing judges. He has a great deal of power when it comes to contentious legal cases. And he is very, very good at spinning himself as a sort of jazz buff. And so he is actually the main Bilderberg person for the UK. He's the main number one Bilderberger. And what with the meeting coming up in June in Spain, the Bilderberg meeting, it's really interesting to see. I mean, he's not going to want to miss that because as many people that analyse these things, like myself, would conclude, is that actually the Bilderberg conference represents a more powerful international force than even national governments do because of the financial clout that it has.
How about this guy Osborne? Now, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he's going to be the main austerity fiend and austerity ghoul. And actually, before we leave Clark also goes back to Thatcher, right? He was in the Thatcher regime.
He rose to power under Margaret Thatcher very, very, very fast. He was involved in many, many controversies, including the Iraqi supergun case, the Matrix Churchill case, where Clark famously at the DTI used these something called a public interest immunity certificate to stop government evidence actually going to the trial. That was pretty unprecedented at the time. And then he became health secretary. His first public appearance was in a Formula One racing car advertising cigarettes on a motor racing circuit. And then he was chancellor for many years. But, I mean, his key role, I don't think, has been anything other than as a Bilderberger. He's a very great friend of the IMF and the World Bank and people like that. You mentioned George Osborne. He's also been along to these Bilderberg meetings. He's sort of, Kenneth Clark has George Osborne sort of under his wing, so to speak. And he's in a very difficult situation because there's quite a progressive economic spokesman for the Liberal Democrat Party, that's Vince Cable, is having to work with George Osborne, who really is much more of a right-wing, let's cut everything type. Now, I'd also point out that both Cameron and Osborne were part of this Oxford Bullingdon Club, which is a sort of club for toffs at Oxford. And it may seem innocent to many people, but, I mean, I could tell you as an Oxford resident from years ago myself, that this club is infamous around the city for being totally lawless. They like getting drunk, they like throwing glasses around, smashing windows, and goodness knows what else they get up to. And it really seems to embed in these people's minds that they're totally above the law. These are not the right people to be running the country. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Can you repeat the name of that club, the Oxford Club?
It's the Bullingdon Club, B-U-L-L-I-N-G, Bullingdon Club,
right.
And it's based, I think, at Brasenose College. Anyway, I don't know if you want to have a chat to Martin before we finish about the economic
situation. Let me just ask you, in terms of Cable and the Liblabs, did the Liberal Democrats have the Robin Hood tax in their manifesto? Did the Robin Hood tax get anywhere in the campaign?
I'm afraid not, Webster. This is Martin Summers here speaking. Hi there. I'm afraid what happened is, I'm a Labour activist, as you know. We didn't win. All the party leaders of the main parties here were in favour of spending cuts. The Conservatives were saying spending cuts now. The Liberals were saying next year, and the Labour Party was saying next year. Now, I'm a Keynesian, and I don't believe in spending cuts now or in the future. We need to have a new deal, as we saw in the US in the 30s, and that means actually expanding government expenditure on things that we need. And all of the political parties here have been bought into this idea that we've got to cut the deficit. And because we're in a capitalist civilization, many ordinary people have bought into this idea as well. We've got a crisis, we've got to tighten our belts. You know and I know what's wrong with that attitude. That is not the way to deal with an economic crisis. It's just totally wrong, and I think that this alliance between the Liberals, the Liberals are a left party, yeah? So an alliance between them and the Republicans, which is effectively what it is not stable. And we are outside the government now, and I would hope to see the trade unions here and the labour movement and the wider social movement put up a hell of a fight to stop spending cuts, for example, on schools, hospitals, and all the, you know, adult education, all of these things that people actually need in a depression and a recession. This is all going to go by the board if we let it. But I don't think the population here have really taken on board the implications of this. And when the cuts start coming down the line, I think we're going to break this coalition and they're not going to stay in power for 5 years.
All right. Now, it looks like the one thing that they agree on is savage austerity, drastic austerity, balance the budget on the backs of working people.
Yeah, that's right. But the opposition to that, the solidest opposition to that comes from the trade unions here. The trade unions actually fund the Labour Party, and they're not very happy with hearing that stuff coming from their top people. Obviously, there's a kind of attempt to find the middle ground, but I don't see how you can find the middle ground. You're either cutting public expenditure or you're not.
Right.
There is no middle ground. And they are definitely intending to cut public expenditure. And I've seen reports done by, you know, right-wing economists in the City of London saying that if there are attempts to cut public expenditure, then the economy will tank. I mean, they know this. They know this because that's exactly what will happen. And the same thing would happen in the US. Now, obviously, you can't run massive deficits forever, but that means you've got to raise taxes on the wealthy classes who profited from the bubble. All of this malinvestment.
And you've also got to force the central bank to issue 0% credit for development. Just a question about the Labour Party. This woman who is now head of the Labour Party, what's with her?
Well, she's not going to stand for the leadership. She's a fairly moderate centrist kind of character. Think Nancy Pelosi, something like that. She's not a bad person. She's not a good person. She's just, you know, a nothing sort of person. But she's not going to stand for the leadership.
Okay, I told her. The music tells us we're out of time, Martin. Thank you to Tony and Martin. We'll try to get you guys back soon to get an update about the evolution of the crisis. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having us on, Webster. We'll speak to you soon.
Bye-bye. Back in the news on World Crisis Radio.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
This radio, of course, that that British regime is led by elitists, oligarchs, Cameron from Eton and Oxford, and so forth. And this guy Osborne seems to embody the mentality of the wealthy elitist. So he's going to be the austerity dictator. And as Tony Gosling and Martin Summers were pointing out, it's very likely that this government will fall soon. It's an unprincipled coalition between the Tory conservatives, who are more reactionary than they look, and as the Thatcher elements in there prove, and these liblabs, who are sort of vaguely leftist. There is this sticking point of Europe. They may well divide on this issue of hedge fund regulation. If Europe wants it, then the liblabs are going to want it, and the Tories, of course, linked to the City of London, are going to be against it. Very good chance that they'll fall soon. So what we had last weekend, of course, was both Germany and Britain entering ungovernability. You now have a very unstable coalition government in Britain, splitting on all sorts of issues, and an unstable situation in Germany where Merkel has lost her majority in the upper house, in the Bundesrat, the Federal Council. She lost the state of North Rhine-Westphalia, the Rhine-Ruhr, ex-industrial heartland, now decimated, but still with some positive tendencies and obviously a great resource to be mobile. She's lost her majority in the upper house, the Federal Council of Bundesrat. That means her laws are also going to be blocked. So two of the most important, Britain and Germany in Europe, entering a phase of ungovernability. In other words, it's burning time. We're back in 1930 to 1931, parliamentary government in crisis everywhere. Let's just go back to Afghanistan now in the remaining time. We pointed out that the war is going badly. It will be a long, hot summer of casualties. The pressure is on Pakistan. This guy Kassab, left over from Mumbai, an operation, now it's clear, planned by Headley of the Drug Enforcement Administration. It's all public. The pressure is now on Pakistan. The U.S. wishes to escalate the existing civil war inside Pakistan. There are now 200,000 Pakistani troops fighting a civil war in Waziristan, these lawless, federally administered tribal areas, north and south Waziristan, along the Afghan border. And the U.S. is demanding, through Petraeus and McChrystal, an escalation of the Pakistan civil war, because that's what it's all about. The U.S. is going into Kandahar this summer on the Afghan side after the abortive Marja offensive, which was slow and much harder than McChrystal had promised. But they're going to push on for Kandahar. They want to overthrow Karzai's brother, who is there. And then on the other side of the border, they want the Pakistani army fighting in Waziristan. Now, this Times Square car bomb, the Patsy, Faisal Shahzad, very fishy. This person's father was, deputy commander of the Pakistani Air Force at one point, high-level military officer coming from what are obviously military intelligence backgrounds. He was sheep-dipped in Waziristan, sent back to a camp. Why do you need to send people to camps in Waziristan? You can set up camps in all sorts of places. You don't need to do this. This whole ritual of sheep dipping the patsies in Waziristan is getting old. It's getting transparent. So we have this guy, and what we find in the New York Times profile is that in 2004, when the patsy Faisal Shahzad sold his house, the Joint Terrorism Task Force was already nosing around him. They came and interviewed the person who bought the house. So the Joint Terrorism Task Force, not the Immigration and Naturalization or any other cops, but Joint Terrorism Task Force is already, they've got Faisal Shahzad on their radar screen in 2004. This cries out, Patsy, Patsy, Patsy. Is there any way to establish that he knew what he was doing when he got this car and got some fireworks? Does that add up to terrorism, or is he not some kind of an Oswald, as has been pointed out, a typical patsy? Anyway, based on this, we have the following blood-curdling threat from Hillary Clinton to Pakistan, saying that if bombs like the Times Square bomb go off, there will be very serious consequences for Pakistan. What does this mean? Meaning that there would be a U.S. land invasion of certain parts of Pakistan? What does it mean? A generic threat, a reckless and irresponsible lunatic threat by Hillary Clinton on this. Also, Hillary Clinton has now openly claimed, pretty categorically, that elements of the Pakistani government are harboring and hiding Osama bin Laden, this mythological figure that U.S. Intelligence pulls out from time to time when they need him for political purposes. Again, in my analysis, he was always a troupe of actors working for the CIA, delivering tapes, statements, and other provocations as needed. In other words, a wholly owned subsidiary, a kind of a production company, as you'd find in Hollywood or whatever, Broadway. So this is the tremendous pressure on Pakistan. And, of course, the U.S. now says the Pakistani Taliban are responsible for the Times Square bombing. This is a fantastic leap, really based on very little. They're arresting people in Pakistan, arresting people here. This is a strategy to foment civil war and the breakup of Pakistan to prevent this country from becoming the energy corridor that it should be between Iran and China, between Iran and India, all things that the U.S. wants to block, and they're trying to do it through Pakistan. Now, the broader issue, the U.S. is collapsing fast in the Middle East. I can't go through the details now, but signs are coming from Saudi Arabia and from Egypt that the Chinese economic offensive is making considerable inroads. These are places where the Iranians have tougher going, but the Chinese are doing very well. The U.S. is becoming marginalized in the Middle East, which was one of the key points of the post-war U.S.-British world empire. This is now becoming alarming. Obama, of course, feckless, drifting. He came in with some pretty aggressive plans, but these aggressive plans now seem to be running into the sand and losing momentum under various cross currents here in the domestic U.S. scene. We've also got the fact that in that new British regime, the foreign secretary, Haig, is profiling himself as a friend of Israel, and above all, for our purposes, Haig says he wants the military attack on Iran kept on the table. Now, whatever we could think about Gordon Brown and Miliband, the outgoing foreign secretary in the labor regime, was somebody who always said, oh, for goodness sake, don't attack Iran. This would be catastrophic. The British Labor Party could see that side of it. But Haig now says, keep the attack on Iran on the table. The danger is therefore this: with a voice in the Anglo-American imperial councils that had been against attacking Iran, now emphatically open to it. They're also, let me point out, Haig would be open to this because this would seal the doom of the U.S. In other words, the U.S. would be essentially a gone duck if the attack on Iran occurs. Haig is for it. This means that we may be drifting towards the attack on Iran through a combination of U.S. weakness and the coming now of Hague, the idea being that if the U.S. says, well, we're getting beaten in some countries by Chinese economic negotiations and development projects, and elsewhere we're getting beaten by the Iranians, the only card we have to play is military action. So let's play it, and let's try to kick over the chessboard and bring in total chaos in the region. So very, very ominous. The attack on Iran getting more likely as a result of Obama's recklessness, as well as these other factors. We'll see you next week on World Crisis Radio.